It is the jaw-dropping, suspenseful story of a celebrated writer who, at the age of 54, decides to take a DNA test on a whim with her husband, and then finds out that her biological father is not the man she loved and whose early death she mourned, but someone else entirely, who she was able to track down through the wonders of the internet within 36 hours of getting the results. She was even able to find, in that short period of time, a YouTube video of the man whose face and mannerisms were very similar to her own. Dani Shapiro's new book, Inheritance, is part detective story, part personal exploration of what makes us who we are, nature versus nurture, and the things that may have been hiding in plain sight. Again, the name of the book is Inheritance, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dani Shapiro to the roundtable this morning. Dani, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Joe. Thank you.
What was it like to, I mean, there's the actual thing that happened, but then the decision that you make to say, okay, I want to write about this, explore it, and share it with a greater audience?
Well, I mean, as a writer, this is in a way the story that I think I probably have been lurking or haunting all of my work, book after book after book for my entire life. So, I mean, I'm a novelist, I'm a memoirist, I've written extensively about family secrets in, I mean, really, you know, you could say that's been one of my biggest themes, and yet I never knew why. And so 3 years ago, when I just stumbled really quite by accident on like this massive family secret, you know, I was the family secret. There was no way I wasn't going to write about that. It was like kismet. It was the book that everything that I've ever written has led to.
This whole thing, as you write about, starts pretty much on a whim with your husband in taking a DNA test. One of the commercial, over-the-counter, as I would call them, DNA tests.
Right. I call them these days, I call them recreational DNA testing.
Yes.
My husband was, he was interested in exploring his own family tree a little bit, and he asked me if I wanted to do mine as well. And I so easily could have said no. I wasn't curious. I thought I knew everything that there really was to know about my family, ancestry, and history. But something, for some reason, that really is just, it could have been otherwise, I said yes. And that was the beginning for me of this huge discovery.
So that discovery being that your biological father is not the man that you grew up with, someone else entirely. One of the beginning amazing things about the story is then once you find out the results of how quickly you start putting pieces together.
Yeah, it was almost like they were waiting there to be put together. So, you know, when you make a discovery like this, I mean, it was shocking and it was really destabilizing. And at the same time, I sort of went on the hunt. My husband and I both, we immediately just started trying to figure it out. It was such a gaping mystery, the idea of suddenly not knowing who your father is after spending, in my case, 54 years with absolute certainty that I knew, you know, where I came from, and suddenly I didn't. And one thing that became very quickly clear to me, I never thought my mother had had an affair. I remembered a conversation that I had had with her many years earlier in which she had let it slip that I had been conceived in Philadelphia. And when I pressed her, she let me know that my parents had had difficulty conceiving me and that they had gone to an institute in Philadelphia that specialized in reproductive medicine and that they had undergone the process of artificial insemination. But she made it very clear to me at the time that that was what my parents did together and it was with my father's sperm. So I really didn't have any cause to question that until the day that I was staring at the results on my computer screen and my father wasn't my biological father, and I understood that it meant that somehow donor sperm had been introduced into that equation and that my biological father was in fact a sperm donor. That was initially that was the first thing that I understood. And then it only took 36 hours, which is just absolutely insane. But it came like this tidal wave of just enough clues, and then I was able to identify and find my biological father within 36 hours. And he was still living, and I, you know, he was very surprised to hear from me.
Did you always know that you wanted to be in touch, that that was something you were going to do, or did you have to think about that?
I did not have to think about it. I was trying to piece together my own identity, and I didn't stop and think, well, wait a minute, do I want to know anything more about who my biological father is? It felt to me urgent and essential that I learn as much as I could.
Your father passed away, died in a car accident when you were 23 years old. And I assume that if he were still living, the story would be different in the sense that you would be able to talk to him about it.
I think it would be different in a number of ways. I mean, one of the things I've thought about recently as the book has been published and it's so out there and I'm talking about it, I wouldn't have written this book if my father was still alive. I mean, let's just start with that. And part of that also is the mystery for me of these were the early days of reproductive medicine. And I went into like major reportage mode of trying to understand as much as I possibly could what my parents went through, what they decided, what they knew, you know, what they undertook. And if my father had been alive, I would have been able to talk with him. But if my mother had been alive, I would have been able to talk with her. But, you know, I think one of the things that I'm seeing as I'm on the road and hearing all these stories from so many people who have been in this situation is that it doesn't always make it exactly easier when the father who raised you is alive, because it's painful. You know, the people who are making these discoveries, their parents wanted to keep this a secret. My parents wanted to keep this a secret. They wanted to go to their graves with that secret, and they did. But then the world changed, and the world in which they conceived a child and were told, go home and pretend this never happened, the child will never know, that world in the early 1960s, that world doesn't exist anymore. And the incredible 1-2 punch of easy, accessible, popular DNA testing and the internet, which is like, you know, rocket fuel, just makes all these secrets come tumbling out in this completely different world that's really only 50 years later, but it's so profoundly different.
This idea, this term that you write about in the book, confused artificial insemination. So just talk a little bit about that. And I ask the question because did your parents really know everything?
I think that from what I can tell, and I did a lot of research and I spoke to anyone still living who had any light to shed on any of this, parents were told, on the one hand, they did sit and have a pretty frank conversation about things like blood type and matching the father's characteristics. They would sign a piece of paper. And yet, at the same time, great pains were taken, not just by the institute where I was conceived, but, you know, all over the country, where, you know, in hospitals and clinics and doctors who were doing this practice, they were told it was a treatment, that it would help the father and boost his chances. They were given every possibility of really managing to tuck it away and go into this place of profound denial as if it had never happened. It just depended on how much of a realist you were. I mean, I've talked to people who really never forgot that that happened, always understood that there was a different biological father, were very conscious of the fact that they were keeping a secret from their children, and sometimes told their children eventually or after the father who raised them passed away. I mean, you know, it would come out. In the case of my parents, I think that my mother tucked this away into a place of very, very deep denial. So that, for example, when my son was born at the same hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, where I had been born 37 years earlier, my mother walked into my hospital room, saw my baby in my arms, and said, he looks just like a Shapiro. And she meant it.
Yeah.
She meant it. She could have passed a polygraph. But I also believe that she knew. But it was a matter of we're truly going to forget this ever happened, because one of the things that I've learned about secrets in general throughout this process is that if you are told that something really, truly can never be discovered. It is possible, in terms of the human psyche, to explode that secret into nothing as if it never happened.
So the obvious question, which I'm sure you've been asked a million times while you've been on book tour, is that if you had had the option of knowing or not knowing, you know, would you prefer not knowing?
No, not for a second, even in the most shocking and painful parts of this in the beginning, because there was always something about me that I didn't completely understand. There was something I couldn't put my finger on. There was a way in which I knew that there was something I didn't know. And I think it drove my life as a writer. I was always digging for it. I mean, why all these memoirs? I've written 5 memoirs. That's just nuts. I was always kind of like searching for the truth, but I couldn't access it. It was way too dangerous to me to have the thought, my dad, who I adored, you know, that he wasn't my biological father, because I, you know, when we're children and we're pretty much given our stories, we're given the keys and the clues to our own identity, and we grow up with those narratives and those stories, and those stories were my bedrock. But I now feel like I have another dimension in my capacity to see both my history and myself. I mean, just one example, all my life, I mean, I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home, but all my life I was told that I didn't look Jewish. But somebody said it every single day, no exaggeration. And so the face, even staring back at me in the mirror, didn't actually make sense. And now it does. And that's very liberating. There's something liberating in knowing the truth. I mean, that old, you know, adage that the truth will set you free, I really feel that. I also, after a lifetime as a writer trying to put together these stories and understand, you know, more and more about human nature, at the end, you know, if we have a moment where we can look back and survey the whole thing when we die, which I don't really believe, but like, let's just say we do. If we do, and I had missed this, I would have just felt like, my God, I got it wrong. I didn't understand something essential about myself. And even though it's been really, really intense to go through this experience, I am really grateful that I have all the information.
So what is your overall feeling about these recreational DNA kits?
Here's a statistic for you. Last year, 12 million of these kits were sold. And they're often holiday gifts. I mean, so ironic, but they, you know, they're holiday gifts, stocking stuffers at Christmas time. Out of those 12 million kits, approximately 2% of the people who purchase these kits and do their DNA testing discover what's known in that industry as an NPE, which stands for not parent expected. 2% of 12 million people in 1 year. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are making these discoveries every year right now, often with parents who are still living. And there are parents who are suddenly in the position of kind of a reckoning. Like, do we tell our grown children at this point that we have kept a secret from them all their lives? Or do we go to the grave with this, knowing that those adult children are going to find out? So there's in a lot of homes and a lot in the privacy of a lot of bedrooms and a lot of conversations are happening around this right now.
The thing about it too, and you brought this out a moment ago, but there was an anonymity to this. Your biological father is a sperm donor and is being told no one will ever know.
Yes, well, he was being told that in 1961.
Right.
And that's an interesting ethical conundrum. I mean, on my book tour, I'm going to be actually speaking in several bioethics departments, one at Harvard and one at Stanford, because I get to talk about this from the inside, which is a very rare thing to be able to do, and something I feel very privileged and thankful that I get to have a voice in this. But, you know, donors who relied on anonymity during a time when anonymity could be guaranteed, again, the world changed. So what does that mean? And what does someone who has donated sperm under the cloak of anonymity owe his biological offspring, if anything? It's a question. And what do those offspring who discover those donors, because they are discoverable now, whether or not they themselves have done DNA testing. I mean, my biological father did not do DNA testing. It was a nephew of his who, you know, showed up as a first cousin of mine. So everyone is discoverable now. And so then the question becomes, what is ethical? What is fair? What is kind? What is true? What do we owe each other in this new world that we find ourselves in?
Danny Shapiro is the author of the new book, Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. She will be at an Oblong Books event at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut on Tuesday, the 19th of March at 6 p.m. You can find out more by going to oblongbooks.com. Oblongbooks.com, again, Tuesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. Danny Shapiro, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A delight to have you on the program.
Same, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. Danny Shapiro will be at an Oblong Books event at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut for a talk and a Q&A on Tuesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. You can find out more by going to oblongbooks.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.